Clinicians are inundated with ads for genetic testing, but is genetic testing currently helpful for informing clinical care? The latest issue of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report includes an interview with Dr. Aaron Besterman. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist at the Rady Children's Hospital Inpatient Child and Adolescent Unit here in San Diego. He also conducts psychiatric genetic research as a clinical investigator at the Rady Children's Institute for Genomic Medicine. In our interview with Dr. Besterman, he broke down the current state of genetic research in psychiatry, explaining how these genetic tests work and what can be reliably taken away from them. Mara and I will discuss the highlights from our interview with Dr. Besterman in this episode. Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast. This is a special episode from the Child Psychiatry team. I'm Dr. Josh Fader, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report and co-author of the Child Medication Factbook for Psychiatric Practice.
And I'm Mara Government, a licensed clinical social worker in Southern California with a private practice, and I'm also a regional director at Positive Development Institute.
Genetic testing is a very complicated landscape, and Dr. Besterman expressed that there's only really one important distinction that clinicians should be aware of.
There's sort of two types of testing that's available. There's what's known as diagnostic genetic testing, where we're doing a genetic test to identify a specific disorder. And then there's pharmacogenetic testing, where we're looking at a cluster of genes to try to understand how individuals respond to medication. So these are two very different things and are indicated for different patients. So starting off with diagnostic genetic testing, at the current time, this is really only indicated for patients with neurodevelopmental disorders. So this includes intellectual disability, a history of developmental delay, or autism spectrum disorders. And the current guidelines state that we should be offering all of these patients certain types of genetic testing. And the genetic testing that's currently recommended is what's known as chromosomal microarray testing. And what this testing does is it detects large genetic changes, deletions or duplications. So we normally have two copies of a gene, one inherited from mom, one from dad. And if a large region of our chromosome gets either duplicated, you end up with three copies, or if it gets deleted, you end up with one copy. And this chromosomal microarray can detect these changes, these deletions or duplications.
Studies have shown that in 10 to 20% of patients with neurodevelopmental disorders, CMA can detect a change associated with a specific genetic syndrome. It's also recommended that patients get testing to look for Fragile X syndrome.
Dr. Besterman mentioned that diagnostic testing doesn't significantly alter psychiatric care, and that's important for patients and families to know, but it can be useful in a number of other ways.
For example, it can inform providers about the need to monitor for common comorbidities with some genetic conditions. It can also provide families with an answer for why their child has a certain condition, which can provide relief to those who've been on a diagnostic odyssey, going from specialist to specialist looking for an answer.
It can help families connect with other families who have a child with a similar genetic condition for social and emotional support. Genetic testing also helps with reproductive counseling.
Lastly, diagnostic testing can plug families into clinical research opportunities where kids could be enrolled in research studies specifically for their genetic condition.
This is an important point because these large studies can certainly provide families with valuable information about their child. A lot of them are now doing sophisticated genetic testing, and the chances of finding a genetic cause for their child's disorder is increasing.
These studies also provide neurobehavioral evaluations that can be helpful for families too.
So we've been hearing a lot about polygenic risk, and specifically, there's a lot of talk about polygenic risk scores. In our interview with Dr. Besterman, we touched on this topic and how it applies to the field of psychiatry.
Polygenic risk refers to the idea that complex medical disorders, like a lot of our psychiatric disorders, like depression and schizophrenia, anxiety, basically all common psychiatric disease, are typically not caused by a single gene change, but instead are caused by the accumulative effect of dozens, hundreds, or thousands of tiny little genetic changes that we both inherit from our parents and sort of arise new during development. And so what people have done is through what's known as genome-wide association studies, where they compare large groups of individuals with a disease with individuals who do not have that disease and look for genetic differences between those groups, look specifically at these very small genetic changes. And for many of our psychiatric disorders now, we've been able to identify dozens, if not hundreds, of these small genetic changes that seem to increase an individual risk by a tiny amount. But what you can do, instead of looking at each one individually, because each one doesn't make a huge change, is you can look at a cumulative risk score. You can add up the effects of all of these tiny changes into what's known as a polygenic risk score.
Wow. It seems like polygenic risk scores have a lot of applications in psychiatry and medicine as a whole. Can we use this risk score to predict the future onset of a disease?
Unfortunately, with the current state of psychiatric genetic research, we really can't use polygenic risk scores in our practice.
According to Dr. Besteman, the risk scores are not good enough yet to predict with any clinical certainty that someone will have one of these psychiatric disorders.
The future goal isn't to necessarily use these risk scores in isolation. The goal is to combine them with other potential risk factors to try to improve our prediction of the onset of a disease. But this is still very much in the research realm and it has not been proven to be clinically useful yet.
Right now, these polygenic risk scores associated with small, little genetic changes are significantly worse at predicting disease likelihood in minority populations or non-European ancestry populations.
Genetic research in psychiatry over the past decade or so, where there's been the most progress, has largely been in Caucasian populations, individuals of European ancestry. And so this has unintentionally created additional disparities where the genetic information that we do know is disproportionately relevant and useful to individuals of European ancestry and is less relevant, less generalizable to individuals of other ethnicities and races. And so the risk scores are much, much worse at predicting disease likelihood in minority populations or non-European ancestry populations. That's something that is very actively trying to be corrected. But at the current time, the genetic information that we have probably is more relevant to individuals of European ancestry than African American or other minority ancestries. And so we really need to do a better job there.
And when it comes down to providing your patients with proper counseling after they've received their genetic test results, there are a few different options.
If you feel comfortable providing counseling on your own, then go for it. The guidelines for genetic testing and genetic education from the International Society of Psychiatric Genetics, ISPG, are a helpful and informative resource. We placed a link to the ISPG guidelines in our latest newsletter.
However, there are alternatives. If you're not fully comfortable with providing counseling, two excellent resources to work alongside with are medical geneticists, who are MDs, and non-MD genetic counselors.
Genetic counselors are experts in genetic medicine and often work alongside medical geneticists. They can facilitate genetic testing, consenting for genetic testing, and counseling to accompany test results. And you can find one through the National Society of Genetic Counselors.
You can work alongside genetic specialists to make sure patients get what they need. If you order a test and it comes back positive, you could refer the patient to a medical geneticist for further counseling. Even if it comes back negative, you could refer to a geneticist if you feel the patient might benefit from more sophisticated testing.
Okay, so that's diagnostic testing. Let's move on to the more controversial type of testing, pharmacogenetic testing.
This type of testing looks at a group of genes involved in drug metabolism or involved in how our body responds to drugs and our particular sensitivities to drugs.
Right now, the recommendations in psychiatry are really three genes that they recommend testing for. One is CYP2D6, that metabolizes a lot of antidepressants and antipsychotics and atomoxetine. And then there's CYP2C19, which metabolizes citalopram, escitalopram, and sertraline. They recommend testing for these genes because it can tell us how fast or slow you metabolize these medications. It doesn't tell us how well you're going to respond to them, but it tells you how fast or slow. The last gene that they recommend is one known as HLA-B, which is a gene that can predispose people of Asian descent to carbamazepine hypersensitivity. And that risk, if you have the risk gene, is greatly, greatly elevated. And so this is definitely indicated for patients who are being started on carbamazepine.
There's also been discussion about whether this should be done for people who might be started on a cousin drug, oxcarbazepine, and even lamotrigine, which has also been associated with Stevens-Johnson syndrome. However, it's really not so clear that one would need to get testing for those as much as for carbamazepine.
Okay, to sum it up, CYP2D6, HLA-B, and CYP2C19 genes are the only ones that are recommended in psychiatry. Even though we hear a lot about other ones, like the MTHFR gene and the COMT gene.
Yeah, there's a lot of marketing for those particular genes, especially for the corresponding L-methylfolate supplementation. We asked Dr. Besterman about how these genes got thrown into the mix.
These are genes that sort of came up a little over a decade ago during what you might call the candidate gene era of psychiatric genetics, meaning we really didn't have much information about the genetic architecture of psychiatric disease. So researchers were making their best guess about which genes might be related to psychiatric illness based on some basic understanding of the neurobiology. And that's when these genes really sort of came to the awareness of psychiatric geneticists. And the evidence supporting their role in either a risk for genetic disorders or drug response in psychiatric treatment is still somewhat limited. And in general, they're ordering genetic tests for these two genes is not particularly informative or helpful for our psychiatric patients.
That's not to say that those genes have absolutely no role in the neurobiology of psychiatric illness, but there is insufficient evidence to say testing for changes in those genes will alter our care in any way.
There are a lot of direct-to-consumer commercial companies like the well-known 23andMe in the world of pharmacogenetics.
These companies send patients and their doctors a report that puts medications in green, yellow, and red boxes. But how they come to those conclusions is not well understood.
Dr. Besterman is apprehensive about utilizing medication recommendations from these companies. And his apprehension is, well, justified.
If you compare the recommendations between companies, they're often very inconsistent.
There was a study a few years ago by Bozeman and colleagues. They took patient samples and sent them to different direct-to-consumer laboratories and compared their specific medication recommendations.
There is a lot of inconsistency between the companies, not only in the specific genotypes, but also in the metabolic phenotypes, meaning whether they thought a given patient was a poor, intermediate, or rapid metabolizer. And the medications that they were putting into green, yellow, and red boxes were also very different.
It's unclear how these companies arrive at and make their recommendations, which is a big problem caused by the lack of standardization in the field.
Fortunately, the FDA started sending cease and desist letters to some of these companies last year. The field is undergoing some evolution, and that's probably a healthy thing. Dr. Besterman cautioned us that the information obtained from the pharmacogenetic testing can be very misleading and can potentially even cause harm.
Definitely. I recently saw two patients whose families insisted on getting a pharmacogenetic test to see what medication their child should have. In both cases, I told them I didn't think the test would tell us anything, and it would be expensive and might even suggest things that aren't helpful. One family hasn't done it yet, maybe because of the cost. I already started the other patient, a teen, on fluoxetine because that's what the clinical data supported. The kid had a great response to fluoxetine, but the test report said that it was in the, quote, red, unquote, box, and therefore recommended against using it. Instead, it had desvenlafaxine in the green box, and we all know from two controlled studies that desvenlafaxine has no evidence that it's better than placebo in teens who are depressed.
This is exactly what Dr. Besterman warned us about. Specifically, these tests can drive patients to not use medications that could potentially be helpful, or to stop medications that are already helpful because families don't understand what it means for the medication to be in a red box.
A lot of patients come to us and say, I had a relative, they had this test, it showed them why their medication didn't work. Now they're on a different medicine, they're doing great, and I want the test too. Personally, I like to stick with the common sense approach in psychiatry, which is that each individual patient is unique, and we really need to assess them individually. So it's important to really understand what their goal is and then decide whether pharmacogenetic testing might be potentially helpful for that specific patient.
And this can be a difficult situation to navigate because it's comforting to see data supporting which medications will help and which ones won't. But patients and families should know that pharmacogenetics does not reveal whether someone will respond well to a medication, and since direct-to-consumer companies are not consistent in their recommendations, patients should know that these tests shouldn't be the main component directing our treatment plans.
Overall, we are still in the beginning stages of incorporating genetic research into psychiatry.
As we learn more down the road, we might be able to use diagnostic and pharmacogenetic testing to inform psychiatric care because there are some benefits to them. But at this present moment, we're just not ready yet.
Our interview with Dr. Besterman was much needed because, frankly, psychiatric genetics is a big and unwieldy field when you think about it.
From the inconsistencies between direct-to-consumer companies to the large studies that are only really generalizable and relevant to Caucasian of European descent.
And on top of that, there's a lot to be aware of when it comes down to which genes can tell you what about a patient and which genes lack the evidence behind them to substantially inform you of anything.
Nevertheless, there are many beneficial things that we can currently take away from the use of genetic testing in psychiatry.
But hopefully in the future, we can incorporate genetics in psychiatry to an even greater extent and ultimately improve treatment for our patients.
Dr. Besterman has a bottom line message that he wants our listeners to know.
The bottom line message for psychiatrists is try to learn more about genetics. It is a growing area of medicine and is going to permeate all fields, including psychiatry, more and more with time. And so I think you'll really be doing a service both to yourself and to your patients to learn more about genetics and genetic testing in psychiatry.
There are many resources out there to gain more insight into the world of psychiatric genetics. Dr. Besterman has co-written some reviews regarding what psychiatrists need to know about genetics that are freely available on PubMed, and we posted a link to his reviews in our newsletter.
In addition to the ISPG, there's also the National Neuroscience Curriculum Initiative, or NNCI. which is an incredible education resource with many online modules that take you step by step through easily digestible scenarios, including genetics.
The print interview is available for subscribers to read in the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report. Hopefully people will check it out. Subscribers get print issues in the mail and email notifications when new issues are available on the website. Subscriptions also come with full access to all the articles on the website and CME credits.
And everything from Carlatt Publishing is independently researched and produced. There's no funding from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, the newsletters and books that we publish depend entirely on reader support. There are no ads, and our authors don't receive industry funding. That helps us bring you unbiased information that you can trust.
Go to www.thecarlattreport.com to sign up. You can get a free subscription to any of our three newsletters for $30 off using the coupon code LISTENER. LISTENER. There are a lot of doctors and nurse practitioners listening, and quite a few students and residents as well. Everyone who responded was interested in getting some kind of CME credit for listening.
So we're going to do it. We're working on putting that program together now, and as soon as it's available, you'll be able to take a post-test for listening to these podcasts and get credits. Everyone who took the survey is going to get early notification when it's ready because we have their email address. So if you'd like to get that early notification, you can still take the survey at www.thecarlattreport.com/podcast survey.
As always, the links you need are in the episode description. Thanks for listening and have a great day.